everyone would like to get started. I'd like to welcome Dr. Zolti from Montefiore to give us a lecture tonight on CHF. Just giving her the final attention.
I hope almost everyone knows me, huh?
Yes.
I believe. And you are used to my accent? It's okay? So please, I'm used to repeat everything 5 times at least. Now it's about 2 hours, but please stop me, interrupt me if something is not clear. I would like to start with a typical case of heart failure. And there are 5 mistakes. And your job is to find these 5 mistakes, and then we'll go to the chief resident. It's a 42-year-old African-American man, that's important, who recently moved from Kansas. He was diagnosed with systemic hypertension about 3 years ago. 2 years ago, he was diagnosed with severe congestive heart failure. His echocardiogram showed a left ventricular end diastolic dimension, and we'll speak about that, of 6.6 centimeter. Does it mean anything for you? What are left ventricular end diastolic dimension? So what's a normal size heart? It's 57, yeah, excellent. So usually we say 57 to 61. Up to 57 is... You were there already. You heard that. Okay. It's up to you.
I think
50, up to 57 is normal. 57 to 61 is mildly dilated. 61 to 63... is moderately dilated. Above 63 is severely dilated. So it's a really enlarged heart. Left ventricular end systolic is also enlarged. Severe global hypokinesis with an EF of 30%. The right ventricle was moderately hypokinetic. Severe mitral regurgitation and moderate to severe TR. Next. The patient at that time underwent a left heart catheterization with clean coronary, LV angio EF of 27%, 3+ MR, meaning moderate to severe, no surgery, his family history is unremarkable, no allergy. Next. And Kansas treated him with 100 milligrams of COSA. And this is my 5 mistakes. Not mistakes, something better. Etanolol 50 milligrams a day, spironolactone 50 milligrams, Lasix, amlodipine, Norvasc 10 milligrams once a day. On physical examination, the patient was hypotensive, heart rate of 88, anictoric afebrile, acyanotic, his JVP was slightly up, chest was clear, no crackles, no rolls, no wheezing. There was a S1, S2, S4, no S3, mitral regurgitation. The abdomen was soft, no tenderness, no hepatosplenomegaly, no edema. So essentially, unremarkable physical examination. Next, lab, hemoglobin of 15, a little bit hyponatremic, creatinine of 1.2, CO2 24, LFTs were normal, UA completely normal, EKG, normal sinus rate, left bundle branch block, with a QRS of 150, chest X-ray, cardiomegaly. Next. So, sorry, 6 mistakes. When I said mistake, it's not a real mistake. Let's go back to the treatment. What's wrong? Oh, not wrong, but...
Do you ignore a job?
Okay, so I heard amlodipine. What's wrong with amlodipine? It doesn't what?
Improve the heart failure. It worsens the symptoms. The calcium channel blockers worsen the symptoms of the heart failure.
True, except amlodipine.
Right.
So, there was a trial called PRAISE 1. And just to show you how biased are all these drug companies. As you know, there were several studies looking at vasodilator and heart failure, like adralazine, isozorbide, VHEFT1, VHEFT2. And they showed that vasodilator does help heart failure, improve mortality. So they wanted to see if amlodipine, Novavax at that time, did improve mortality. And they took about 2,000 patients, placebo versus Novavax, and they showed that in the non-ischemic cardiomyopathy group, like this patient, amlodipine did improve survival. Great news for Pfizer. The problem was that it was underpowered because it was just in the non-ischemic cardiomyopathy. So they did a PRAISE 2 study, took only non-ischemic cardiomyopathy, and in fact, Novavax did not improve survival. And the PRAISE 2 study was never, ever published. I have the paper, belonged to Pfizer, but was never, they never wanted to publish because they wanted people to stay with the impression that non-ischemic cardiomyopathy does help. So, after PRAISE 2, the conclusion was heart failure, if a patient is still hypertensive on the other medicine like ACE, beta blocker, and third line, you can add amlodipine. It doesn't harm, but it doesn't help. Okay, so in this patient, amlodipine, I'm not sure I would give him. There are some other medicine to give him before amlodipine. What about COSA? Correct? Losartan, yes.
There was no contraindication to an ACE. I don't know if it's a class effect for heart failure or...
So is there any difference between ACE and ARB? So again, there is, and that was published. There was Elite 1 showing comparing ACE versus Losartan, and Elite 1 again showed that COSA was superior to ACE inhibitor. But it was again under power.
Was this in a black population or they didn't make it?
Elderly population above 65. And CHF, it's an elderly disease. So it was under power, so they had to repeat the study and showed that, in fact, ACE was a little bit superior. It was not statistically significant, but ACE was still superior. So guidelines-wise is you should start with an ACE. If the patient is intolerant to an ACE, then you switch to an ARB. But you don't start with an ARB. And if you start with an ARB, what's the problem? QD. COSA, losartan is a BID drug. So we've got three mistakes. Etanolol. Correct. Any study with etanolol? None. In heart failure, none. Post-MI, yes. But CHF, none. Only indication for etanolol?
If they have asthma. Sometimes patients will start with the A because it has more beta, less beta effect for the asthmatics or some with severe COPD. Etanolol is more.
Etanolol versus what?
Versus metoprolol.
Are you sure? So, I'll answer to you, why not using bisoprolol? That's the MADIS trial. So you've got three medicine. So if a patient is asthmatic, no etanolol, it's bisoprolol. Etanolol was never studied in heart failure patients. The only indication you could use is when the patient is severely depressed. Etanolol doesn't cross the barrier. So etanolol here is wrong. So what would you choose for a beta blocker? Or metoprolol? Which one would you choose? Coreg or metoprolol?
Coreg has to be dosed more.
Depends if you follow prescription drug studies. If you choose pharmaceutical, all these pharmaceutical studies. The COMET study.
Okay, so what does the COMET study show?
To metoprolol,
the short acting.
And it was underdosed, and the heart rate between the groups were different.
But still, Coreg is considered to be superior to metoprolol. Okay, spironolactone, everyone?
Yes. Class 3, class 4.
Spironolactone? Yeah, you're right. And this patient is class. And what about the dosage, 50?
25,
but you could go up to 50. That's okay. Lasix, yes, and what's missing?
African-American.
Sorry, I'm in your way. I know I move a lot. What's missing? Why? It was not IMDO. It was isozorbide, dinitrate. So, okay, he's African American, a heft, so that's missing. So, before starting him on amlodipine, I would start him on isodil and hydralazine, especially in the setting of severe mitral regurgitation, because it's a vasodilator. Mitral regurgitation is being helped, but that's number two topic. And what else? The oldest drug.
Aspirin.
Why aspirin?
Because what? High risk. He's got heart failure. He probably has coronary artery disease. All these guys should be on aspirin.
Show me evidence.
He's got billions of papers.
Heart failure, aspirin. Why not Comedin?
Why is he in heart failure?
Why?
Why not? Most commonly, he has coronary artery disease.
He does not. He had clean course.
Oh, yes.
What's the most likely, what's the cause in his case?
Is he alcoholic? No.
He's African American. Most likely hypertension.
So he's
okay.
DC?
What?
Coumadin.
Coumadin versus aspirin. We don't know the answer. It's ongoing now. There was a trial called Watch showing no superiority of Coumadin versus aspirin.
But you would put him on one after.
Yeah, but it's extrapolation from post MI. There's no good data. I mean, just because you believe that heart failure has a hypercoagulable state. It's just coming. There is no study per se with aspirin and heart failure. Randomized trial. Would you do such a trial? I don't think it's completely ethical. No one would not be on aspirin. What else? It's quite, yeah. Digoxin. What does digoxin do? Symptom relief and?
Less admissions.
Less admission. Be careful. Level of dig is very, very important. when they did the DITCH trial, and that's also the next time, they look when they stratify by level, they showed that if the level is above 1-1, you increase mortality. So you really need, in heart failure patient. So when you put somebody on DITCH, be careful not to overdose him, because any inotrope drug, milrinone, dobutamine, enoxaparin, which is the PO milrinone, all of them increase mortality. So not milrinone. So DIG, and the last one is? Yeah. Statin. Decrease mortality. Can I go to the, not the, two more slides? Yeah. What else can you do for this patient? So the ICD by V, both?
He has a prolonged QRS that has been shown
to improve mortality. Okay. And what about the ICD?
Isn't he at 27%?
Okay. Good. Very good. Okay. Now my talk. Let's next. Heart failure. I'm going to speak a little bit how important it is. A little bit of pathophysiology, diastolic versus systolic, clinical presentation, assessment of heart failure, hemodynamics. I hope I've got 30 minutes.
In the last slide, there were also a couple of other questions. In the last slide.
Oh, yeah. So let's go back. So what's the next step? Oh, yes. So we spoke about the next step. By VICD, changing all his meds, coming to Jacobi, changing that. Is the patient a candidate for mitral valve repair? Remember, he had severe mitral regurgitation.
Did he have a bit worse? What were the causes? If you close the valve, probably the heart could have been worse.
Not absolutely. But when you've got severe mitral regurgitation, how much of your volume, left ventricular and diastolic volume, goes backwards? Let's say it's 100 cc, just to make it simple. What percentage? 60% of your ejection volume, ejected volume goes back. So should we operate on his valve? Who says yes? So 10 years ago, people would say yes. I would say no. Why? Why does he have mitral regurgitation? Because the heart is dilated. Okay, it's stretched out. If you repair the valve after 2 weeks, the ring is going to be stretched out again, and 3 weeks later, the patient will be again in mitral insufficiency.
So,
I would not. I mean, it's useless.
So, why not 10 years ago they thought like this?
If you still ask a surgeon, he's going to tell you, yes, let's do it. But they absolutely do not improve. In fact, they do worse. Does the patient need a transplant evaluation? What would you do first? And then, yeah?
And then give LV remodeling.
Are you deciding transplantation about remodeling?
I'm saying, would you consider that in these, if you're considering transplant, would you consider that in this patient?
What would you do as next step to decide if the patient is a transplant candidate?
Well, he's not even up to needing an LVAD yet, either.
How do you know?
It's a clinical judgment. How is he performing?
is able to walk five blocks.
So he's not there.
He's telling you. Usually they lie. They overestimate what they are able to do. We presented a paper showing that there's a very poor correlation between your own assessment and a VO2 exercise test, a treadmill test. And this is the strongest predictor factor. It's you need to put them to do a VO2 test on a treadmill. And if your exercise capacity is really low, that predicts that the patient will need a transplant or not. So at this question, I would say the patient needs to have a treadmill with VO2 to measure. Okay, let's next one. Okay, so heart failure is a syndrome. It's a clinical syndrome. Okay, that's important. Impaired left ventricular performance could be systolic, diastolic, or both. Usually when you do have systolic dysfunction, you also have diastolic. You have reduced functional capacity. Neurohormonal dysregulation, we'll speak about that, the renin-angiotensin system, the sympathetic nervous system, fluid retention, impaired quality of life, increased mortality. Next. About 10 million, it's a really important problem. About 10 million of Americans suffer from heart failure, which represents 1.5%, 2% of the U.S. population. The incidence of heart failure has markedly increased over the last 30 years. It's also a disease of elderly people. You've got more than 1 million admissions every year for CHF in the United States. It's the single largest expense for Medicare. And the 5-year mortality remains very high, more than 50% if you are in class 2, 3, or 4. Next. So just to show you how much, how 10 million of people are suffering from heart failure. Next. Prevalence goes also by age. The elder you get, the more prevalent is the disease. Next. And you see that despite treatment with beta blocker ACE inhibitor, annual death continue to increase. The definition of death here was modified, therefore you've got... I don't exactly understand how it could be modified, but... Okay, initially in the 50s, most patients with heart failure, systolic heart failure, had idiopathic hypertensive, not much coronary artery disease. I just believe they didn't diagnose correctly coronary artery disease. And today, most of our heart failure, here it's for systolic dysfunction, suffer 70% are ischemic cardiomyopathy, and the remaining are hypertensive valvular idiopathic. Next. You are all familiar with the New York Heart Association functional capacity. When you are class 4, shortness of breath with minimal or even at rest. So you see here the annual mortality. Class 2, 5 to 15%. Class 3, up to 50%. Class 4, up to 70%. But what's interesting is sudden death. And you see that if you are in class 2, you've got much more risk of sudden death than class 4. Interesting. So NAICD is mostly based on the EF, not in class. By V, do you remember the indication for to put a by V?
Long QRS.
Long QRS, but you need to be in class 3 or 4. Class 2, no by V.
Why the mortality is high in class 2?
In what? In which one? Class 4?
Class 2.
Mostly from pump failure.
Pump failure?
Yeah. But in function 4, for instance, mostly pump failure. It's not arrhythmia.
In the two? It should not be that bad. Why the sudden death is so high?
Because the pump doesn't fail so easily. It's mostly compared to pump failure.
But the absolute numbers, I guess, increase as we go to a more progressive.
Yeah, absolute number, but the class 4, usually you don't have so many patients. And all these numbers, in fact, to be very honest, are small studies done. People became famous because it was done 30 years ago with 20. This study will never be accepted today. Next one. So that was an interesting study also done in the late 80s. They studied 20 patients on the waiting for a heart transplant. And this patient had a sudden death event. And they look what was this event. And so 8% had died from sinus bradycardia. Eight of these 20 had a VFib, VTAC arrest. Two out of these 20 PA and AV block. So don't think that it's only VTAC, VFib. Could be PA, could be sinus bradycardia, and then dead. Next. Annual incidence is higher in men than women. Men also, when they are diagnosed, survive shorter than women. And again, the cost of heart failure is tremendous. In 2000, it was $60 billion. And I believe now in 2010 is even more. Heart failure is the highest DRG, even compared to cancer or MI. Next. So let's speak a little bit about pathophysiology. Next. Okay. Cardiomyopathy. Heart failure is due to cardiomyopathy. Primary could be dilated, hypertrophic, restrictive, arrhythmogenic, as you know. Or secondary, ischemic, the most common, valvular, due to rheumatic heart disease, hypertension, or other. That's the classification of the WHO. Next. So, heart failure, it's a forward and backward heart failure problem. Could be just one, or could be both. So, very often does forward mean your ejection of blood in the aorta is decreased and you don't perfuse. So usually it's what we called, do you remember, wet and dry, wet, cold, or warm? So that causes cold. Backwards, heart failure, so cannot empty your venous reservoir and you've got congestion. Your liver, your kidney, your legs. Next. So again, it's the same thing. Left heart failure, right heart failure. Left atrial pressure, you have shortness of breath, pulmonary congestion, pulmonary edema. Low cardiac output could also be due to right heart failure. Fatigue, renal insufficiency, poor mentation. Right, and if you've got right heart failure, your GVPs are your edema, renal failure, hepatic insufficiency. When you see a patient with a low cardiac output sleeping on the table, you need to admit him. But right away, because that's really a sign of low cardiac output. Next. So that's a normal cardiac output, 5. Do you know how to calculate a PVR, SVR? Do you remember that? That's going to be 10 questions on your medical boards. Easy to get. And we'll speak about that if you've got the patient. So a normal wedge is, what is a wedge? Do you know what does it represent? Left atrial pressure and what else? If there is no mitral stenosis, no
LV
end diastolic, okay? That's, so what's a normal wedge? Twelve or lower, okay? RA or CVP is the mean. Up to 5 is normal. PA, we look at the mean. 25 is, up to 25 is normal. So heart failure, low cardiac output, high SVR, and we'll speak about the systemic resistance, systemic vascular resistance, and high PVR, low cardiac output. CVP is high. LVEDP 35. What's the difference between? You see the wedge and the LVEDP are about the same. Very important. We'll speak about that. Next. So, do you remember the definition of preload and afterload? Preload is mostly the volume. Okay, how much volume in your heart dilate your sarcomere, and that's the Frank Starling, the more stretch you do have, the better contraction. And afterload is mostly the resistance that the ventricle must overcome to eject blood. Next, so afterload, preload, just to remind you. So the stroke volume depends on the afterload and preload. The afterload is mostly the vascular tone, the resistance. The preload is mostly depending on the vascular tone and the blood volume. Stroke volume and contractility, cardiac output, heart rate also play a role in cardiac output. Next. And here you've got the Frank Starling curve. That's a normal heart. And when you have heart failure, you are on this line. And if you push here, you are congested. If you push here, you are hypoperfusing. Okay, what you are trying to do with the butamine and milrinone is to push back to this line. Do you remember all this, or do I need to go in more details? Okay, next.
How long can you keep a patient on milrinone?
Yeah, but what do you mean by ever?
I mean, you're giving an inotrope.
We've given milrinone for years.
For years.
Yeah. What's the difference between the butamine and milrinone?
Essentially.
Yes. Yeah, but what's the main? The butamine is a receptor difference, yes. But what's the difference between the butamine and milrinone? With what? No, the butamine is a pure beta 1. And milrinone is a phosphodiesterase inhibitor. But from a hemodynamic standpoint, and that's part two I wanted to do, I'll speak more in detail between the butamine and milrinone, but just for you to remember, what's the essential difference between milrinone and the butamine? Do they have the same effect from a hemodynamic standpoint? Which one? Milrinone is a vasodilator. Okay? The butamine is not a vasodilator. It's a little bit of a vasodilator, but it's not a vasodilator. So if a patient comes in CHF exacerbation with a blood pressure of 80, which one are you going to choose? The butamine, yeah. You are not going to start him on milrinone because his blood pressure may drop. So that's really important. Another difference, very important difference between the butamine and milrinone. Oh, okay, with the tachycardia, I agree. So if a patient is in AFib, don't give the butamine because the AFib is going to get crazy. But another very important difference. Doesn't have any effect on diuresis. You should know. What? In both, it's increased. You kill people with the butamine or milrinone. What's the beauty of dobutamine? It's short life. The patient has any side effect, goes into rapid AFib, you stop after 2 minutes. Milrinone has a half-life of how much?
About a few hours.
6 hours. So if the patient starts to drop his blood pressure, you've got a problem for several hours. And giving him fluid is not the answer. Okay, let's go next one. So, you remember that again, the pressure-volume relationship. And these are what's important to distinguish between diastolic and systolic. So that's the cycle. When you are at the beginning of your diastole, you are here, and this is the end diastolic pressure volume curve. Sorry. And then contraction, isosystole, this is the afterload, and contraction, ejection, and you go back. And this is the end systolic pressure. So what's the difference between diastolic and systolic dysfunction? What's wrong in systolic dysfunction versus diastolic, according to him? Systolic dysfunction, this curve goes here. Diastolic, this curve goes here. Next slide. Okay, so we are in systolic dysfunction. That doesn't change, but the systole hits here. So you are just pushed to the left, and the volume is bigger. Next. In diastole, is the end diastolic curve, which is the problem. So you see the volume is much smaller. And that's the problem with diastolic dysfunction. They don't eject much volume, and therefore they are congested. Next. So again, LV diastolic dysfunction. I know some people don't believe in diastolic dysfunction, but I don't understand why they don't. And we've got, you've seen that while, and I'm sure here, plenty of patients with diastolic dysfunction. It's mostly a problem of decreased relaxation and increased stiffness. Okay? And the stiffness is caused due to fibrosis, and therefore there is now a trial to give spironolactone in this patient to decrease fibrosis and decrease relaxation, mostly due to ischemia or dyssynchrony or hypertrophy. Okay, next. So, abnormal relaxation is, that's the normal pressure volume curve. This is the first part of diastole, which is increased, and the increased stiffness is the second part of the diastole. And if you combine these two curves, you get an increase of this curve. But just remember, in this pressure-volume curve, the problem of diastole is here, systole is the other curve. It's simple, and you remember that. Next one. So again, in diastole, we've seen that. Next. Difference between dilated, normal, and that's diastolic. Next. Systolic 50%, diastolic 50% among the old heart failure. Next. Cause of systolic, mostly, as I said, 70% that come from the SOLVE study. Idiopathic, about 15%. Hypertension, valvular, it's about 30% non-ischemic today. Next. For diastolic, it's 30-30-30, hypertensive, ischemia, or hypertrophic or restrictive cardiomyopathy. That's the main cause of diastolic dysfunction. Next. So, as you know, when you do have heart failure, you activate what kind of system? Let's go to the next slide. Okay, insult, LV systolic function, your cardiac output goes down, your wedge goes up, you activate your renin-angiotensin system, sympathetic nervous system, and you increase your preload, you increase your afterload, you improve in the short term, but in the long term, it's bad. Next. So you all know that, renin-angiotensin activation, sympathetic nervous system, you reduce your systemic perfusion because it's a vasoconstriction. And you cause remodeling, gene expression, ischemia. If what does the renin-angiotensin system does? Vasoconstriction. Yes? So it causes more ischemia on the heart because the heart needs to pump more. Cause apoptosis, cell death, and all this system, mostly the sympathetic nervous system, is directly toxic to the heart. So if you give dobutamine, you kill your patient on the long term. Next. Again, let's go. Next. Again, compare norepinephrine in normal control versus heart failure patient. The level is activated. And norepinephrine is toxic to the heart. So when you give levofet to a patient, ultimately you are going to kill his heart. Next one. And the higher your norepinephrine level is in your blood, the higher is your mortality. You see? Next. Again, how the renin-angiotensin system work. You know that. Vasoconstriction. ACE, renin. Next. Okay. Next clinical presentation. So as we spoke, heart failure cause end organ perfusion, congestion, myocardial ischemia, and arrhythmia. Next. So this is the clinical criteria of heart failure, how to diagnose. That was done 20 years ago, the Framingham heart failure study. If you had two major or one major and two minor, you had the diagnosis of heart failure. Which today it's mostly by echo, systolic, or diastolic. So if you've got a S3, RAS, JVD, PND, you've got heart failure. Next one. Okay. When you do have heart failure, you are mostly looking at what? At the left side of your heart. And you want when a patient is in heart failure, what's his wedge?
Greater.
So it's a small study, but a pretty good study. Looking at, what's the only way to measure your wedge or your LVDP?
To swan
or to do a left cat, but you don't have it. So Stevenson did a small study looking at the relationship between some clinical sign and the wedge measure. And she looked at autopnea. If a patient was complaining of autopnea, and in fact, the sensitivity to have a high wedge of above 22 is pretty good. Specificity is also very, very good. Positive predictive value is 100%. That's great. When a patient is complaining of autopnea, you must think his wedge is high. Pretty good study. Next one. Now, another way. You don't have a cardiac output very easily. Besides if you've got SVC saturation like we did several times. But you could use a proportion pulse pressure. Have you ever used that? It's your systolic minus diastolic divided by your systolic. And if a normal is 0.42, if it's less than 0.25, your cardiac index is less than 2.2, the patient is on heart failure. And you see the positive predictive value is 91%. So if your proportional pulse pressure is less than 25, your positive predictive value is quite high that the patient is in low cardiac output state. How many of you are using that? I can tell you it's useful. Next. Then, you know, when we look at a patient, we always look at the jugular venous pressure. But that look for what? For the right side. Doesn't mean that the left side is bad. So what's the relationship? And in fact, the sensitivity is pretty bad, 57%. However, to the next slide. I'll come back to the crackles, because the crackles is a very bad sign. And do you know why?
It's not specific.
It's completely non-specific. But why is it not specific? Very often, these patients have edema, low cardiac output. You listen to their lungs, no crackles. No? Why don't you hear crackles? How often do you see pure, white, isolated RV failure? You are biased. Yeah, you do develop hypertrophy of your lymphatic system, and therefore you don't hear crackles. So, again, she's working with Stevenson. So they did the combination of JVP and hepatojugular reflux. And if you've got both of them, your positive predictive value is quite good. So if a patient has a JVP plus a hepatojugular reflux, plus, really, if you always try to do a hepatic jugular reflux, you've got a pretty good positive predictive value that your wedge is high. Next. Assessment of heart failure. Okay, first question. Does presentation fit the diagnosis of heart failure? Is it systolic or diastolic? And what's the cause? Next. So history and physical exam, of course, lab, EKG, chest X-ray, echo. Let's go one by one. History is the key, of course. The most symptoms, shortness of breath, fatigue, edema, chest pain. Next. Remember, dry or wet, extremely important. That's maybe one of the most important. If your weight is down, doesn't mean, think about dry. If your BUN and creatinine doesn't mean that the patient is wet. It's usually that he is low cardiac output. Okay, next. When the patient has a low blood pressure, heart rate above 100, and a low sodium, if you don't do something, the patient is dead. And I'll kill you too. Okay, next one, if you don't do anything. So, chemistry. Sodium is low, bad prognostic factor. That means that your vasopressin goes up. Potassium, very often high because of acute renal failure, because you don't perfuse your kidney. BUN creatinine, again, because you don't perfuse your kidney. Always look at LFTs. Troponin to rule out ischemia, you do all the time, and BNP. Don't trust the BNP all the time. It could be completely wrong. Next one. CBC anemia. If you have worked with me, you know that I always look at hemoglobin or hematocrit. If the hemoglobin is low, studies have shown that improving your crit to above 35% improve your survival, your New York Heart Association, your functional capacity, and, as I said, survival. And you should always have a UA to be sure that the patient is not in nephrotic syndrome, that is not hypoalbuminic, which may explain his edema. Next one. Also in acute setting, yeah. Just be sure. It's easy to have a UA to see if he's got protein. The anemia may explain why your patient is in heart failure.
But if they're coming in with acute heart failure, is that evidence that says that it improves mortality, giving them blood right away?
to improve on the long term. Yeah. Not the next day, no, but yes. EKG, of course, ischemia, AFib may cause CHF, Q-wave. If you see Q-wave, most likely it's got poor LV function. Low voltage, think about amyloidosis or pericardial fusion, LVH for diastolic dysfunction. Next one, chest X-ray, you know. Echo, very important, you know that, for to differentiate between systolic or diastolic, or to rule out pericardial disease or any other disease. Next one. And if you suspect, you always need to suspect today coronary artery disease. So very often you send the patient to the cath lab. But if the patient has a creatinine of 2, what kind of test do you prefer to do? A dobutamine stress echo or a nuclear study? So just to show that the sensitivity of DSC is higher than nuclear, but the specificity is worse. Next. Cause of non-ischemic dilated cardiomyopathy, familial, postpartum. But what should you really always think? It's alcohol, cocaine, chemotherapy, TSH. And you should always do a ferritin for hemochromatosis and to be sure that the patient is not iron deficient. Next one. Lack of compliance may cause your patient, and I believe you've got plenty of patients like that. Drugs, hypertension, arrhythmia. Think about anemia. Really, anemia may cause heart failure. Infection. Any infection cause heart failure. Or thyrotoxicosis. Always check a TSH. Next one. Again, heart failure and anemia. So he showed that Silverberg, that was an Israeli study, showed that 56% of patients were anemic. And the more anemic the patient, the worse is his CHF. Next one. And he showed that if he gave to this patient IV iron plus EPO, he improved survival, New York Heart Association functional class, and EF. So this is what we try to do here too. Next one. What kind of drug causes heart failure? Any class 1 anti-arrhythmic agent like quinidine, but we don't use them. Any calcium channel blocker besides amlodipine, even nifedipine, any beta blocker, TZD, never. I'll kill you really if I see a non-steroidal in a heart failure patient. Alcohol, and I did kill a few of alcohol also, of course. Next one. Okay, let's go to hemodynamics. So when do you need to put S1 guns? But you know if the patient is septic. So when do you need... So when a patient comes with pulmonary edema, do you need to put S1 guns? No. Okay, but usually you need to put S1 guns when you treat the patient, the patient is creatinine, despite treatment, start to go up. It can help you really guiding your treatment. So let's give you some number. Next slide. Yeah. So, if you suspect hypoperfusion, if the patients remain hypotensive, you don't know septic, not septic, and if he needs an LVAD, you believe the patient will need a transplant. So, let's go to the next one. That's placement of S1. Next. Okay. SVR. Systemic vascular resistance, mean arterial pressure minus CVP divided by cardiac output, and you multiply by 80. PVR is mean pulmonary artery pressure minus wedge divided by cardiac output. Okay, why is it important, the PVR? Why is it extremely important? A normal PVR, it's about less than 2.5. But let's say your PVR, your patient has an EF of 25% and a PVR of 5. What's your problem? What's the problem of the patient? He's got right side failure, yeah. And so what? So you treat him. The age? Could be left, could be right. We'll discuss about that. But what's the if the patient is really sick, cannot walk 10 steps, he's got a high PVR, if the patient needs a transplant. Okay. If the patient has a high PVR, can you put a new heart? Why not?
Pulmonary vessels already.
It's not going to be able to pump any blood against this pulmonary circulation. The right heart would be hypertrophied in this kind.
Exactly. The right side will crash. And you are going to lose a heart and a life. So if the PVR is above 4, no transplant. So you need to reduce your pulmonary vascular resistance. That's really important. The left side is the new heart. The new right side is a very weak heart. It's not used to have a high pressure like the old one. And if he sees high pulmonary pressure, the RV is going to crash and the patient is going to die. Next one. So, two examples of pulmonary hypertension. One is due to LV dysfunction, and the other one is due to some kind of lung disease. Which one is what? I mean, try not to look at the right side.
The wedge is up.
So, very, very quickly, transpulmonary gradient, you take the mean PA minus wedge. If it's above, if it's less than 15, it's a LV problem, diastolic or systolic. If it's above 15, it's a lung problem, idiopathic, PE, or whatever. But in the second case, 55 minus 12 is 43, it's above 15, okay? Another way to look at that is between the diastolic and the wedge, you should not have a difference of more than 5. If it's the same, if it's within a 5 millimeter of range, it's due to diastolic or systolic dysfunction. Okay, because sometimes you've got a transpulmonary gradient above 15, but it's still due to systolic dysfunction because the wedge and the diastolic are about the same. So just remember that. So you see here 37 with a wedge of 12. There is some kind of lung disease. Important to remember. Next. Okay, let's go quickly. That's 10 questions in your boards, and you should get them in 2 seconds. 40-year-old woman coming to the ER complaining of shortness of breath. What's her diagnosis? Could be, yes. Absolutely normal. Next one. Hypo what? So I'm hearing, so is she in cardiogenic shock?
No.
I mean, the wedge is way too low. I heard what? I heard hypovolemia or what? Septic shock? No, you would expect a high cardiac output. And the SVR of a low SVR.
Compensated systolic failure. The wedge is not high, but it's still.
So the patient is what? Dry?
Yeah.
And cold. Could be. He's really cold. So then you need some. So what would you do? Milrinone or dobutamine? Okay, next one. Hypovolemic? What? So the wedge is high. So is the pressure, the pulmonary pressure high?
Yes.
Yeah, it's above 25, so it's high. Diastolic? Okay. Patient is hypotensive, low cardiac output, cardiogenic, biventricular because his CVP is high. It's not just the left. Okay, next one. The patient is... I'm sorry. I apologize. To be honest. I'm okay. So what's going on? Sorry. So CVP. So there is something where? Okay. Low cardiac output. Low. So what's, again, it's the same woman coming to the ER. You don't have much time to think. P. Okay. It's not usually the case of, I just don't want to give you the response, of primary pulmonary hypertension, because usually the blood pressure is much higher. Okay, so low cardiac output with a low, you need to think about PE. Most likely, yeah. Next one.
SVR is really low.
What else?
That was low CVP.
You're right, sepsis, but what else?
Low CVP. He needs fluids. Distribution.
Yeah.
Cardiac output is high.
Cardiogenic shock with 7.8?
No, the heart's trying to compensate for the hypotensive secondary.
So give me other. Okay, sepsis. What else? What?
Hemorrhage?
No, urogenic. Vasodilator.
Like what? Could be anaphylaxis. What else? For heart failure, what we call high cardiac high output.
So hyperthyroidism,
anemia. Hyperthyroidism, anemia, exactly. So don't believe anemia only can cause the AV malformation like Paget disease. Good. And last one.
Pressure was low, the
SVR
should be higher because of anemia.
Usually the SVR is high, but you can have that with anemia. Just anemia can cause you a vasodilation. So don't exclude anemia as not cause. So that should not take you more than 2 seconds.
Cardiac tamponade.
Yeah, why?
Because everything's equalized.
Yeah, equalization. Good. Next one. Okay. It's what I told you. Let's go. Sorry, I'll give you next time if you want me the treatment for heart failure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sorry for the time.
Are you going to email us this?
It's on the web, right?
Rush, you can get this?
It's on the web. Rush, you can get it on the web.
Rock on. Good job, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure. Was it okay?
Great. The best one you have, no joke. Very interactive, exciting. I think most people fall asleep during these 5 to 6 o'clock lectures, but this is.
If it's interactive, it's.
Yeah, I think it's better. It's in this room. Sometimes they have it.
Yeah, when I got the email that it was in the auditorium,
yeah.
I was.
Right. And then people. It's too formal.
Thank you. I hope I was okay.